Usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this underlying expectation of like precision. It feels almost like engineering.
Right, very mechanical.
Exactly. Like you fall off a ladder, you break your arm, you go to the hospital, and the x-ray shows that jagged white line on a black screen.
Yeah.
And the doctor points to it and says, there it is. That's the problem. It's totally binary. It's broken or it's not broken. It's clean.
It is.
Yeah.
And in a weird way, even though you're in pain, that visual evidence is incredibly comforting.
Oh, absolutely. We like things to be visible. We like our problems to be neatly categorized, so we can apply a direct mechanical fix, put a cast on it, wait 6 weeks, good as new.
Right, because it provides an illusion of total control.
Yeah.
When we can point to the broken bone or the infected tissue or the blocked artery, we feel that we understand the entirety of the situation.
But then you step back, like you zoom out from that single x-ray on the light board and you look at the world of systemic healthcare.
Yeah, the macro view.
Right, you look at the actual sprawling architecture of how we get to that doctor in the first place, and suddenly the diagnostic machinery completely breaks
It really
down.
does. It falls apart.
We're no longer looking at a clean, jagged line on an x-ray. We're trying to diagnose a landscape that is, frankly, incredibly murky. It's a space where the symptoms are like long wait times, exhausted nurses, and overflowing emergency rooms. But the actual disease causing all of this is practically invisible.
It is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters. I mean, to really grasp the scale of what we are talking about today, you'd have to see my workspace right now.
Oh, yeah. What's it look like?
Well, I've spent the last few days mapping this out. I have notes and diagrams plastered everywhere.
Wow.
Yeah, it looks like a schematic of a dimly lit hospital corridor, but as you follow the lines I've drawn, that single corridor slowly branches out.
Okay.
And it transforms into this massive interconnected map of an entire community. It traces roads, ferry routes, bank accounts, and social networks.
That's crazy, just from one hospital hallway.
Exactly. Because the real diagnosis we are trying to make today isn't about biology, it's about tracing the hidden pathways of access.
I love that visual, a map of the hidden pathways, because that's exactly what we are doing today. And we are so glad you are here with us for this deep dive. Yes, you listening right now.
Welcome.
You are the vital third person in this room. And I want you to start by thinking about a specific feeling. Just, think about the last time you had to navigate a complex bureaucracy or a massive medical system, maybe for yourself or maybe for a loved one.
Oh, we've all been there.
Did it feel like you were wandering through a maze blindfolded? Did you get the creeping sensation that you were constantly hitting dead ends?
Right, and that the only way to get through a door was if you magically knew the exact right phrase to say.
Or the exact right insider to call?
Yes, it's a deeply isolating feeling, but it is entirely universal. And what we are going to uncover is that this feeling is not a glitch in the system. There is a profound structural reason for why it feels like a maze.
Which brings us to our mission today. We are digging into an absolutely fascinating 2026 paper by Dr. Bechara Sethaly.
It really is a remarkable piece of work.
Yeah, and it's grounded in the perspective of the Caribbean, which we'll get into later, but the implications are completely global.
Universally applicable, yeah.
The paper proposes this wild, unsettling idea, which is that our medical systems aren't just crowded or underfunded, they have been covertly enclosed.
Enclosed, yeah, that's the key word.
Because we are going to explore this hidden architecture, like a shadow system that quietly dictates who gets care and who gets left behind.
And even more startling, we are going to look at how our health workers are secretly subsidizing this entire broken apparatus with their own well-being.
So, okay, let's unpack this because the author doesn't start with dry statistics about bed shortages. He starts with a story, like a very simple, very human story.
Right, it's a reconstructed, de-identified scenario. But honestly, anyone who has spent more than a week in a hospital environment has seen it play out.
Right. So it goes like this. A doctor receives a phone call. A family member of theirs has been admitted to a local hospital with a potentially serious infection.
So immediately, high stakes.
High stakes. The doctor is worried. They aren't the treating physician, and they aren't quite sure what's going on with the care plan.
And they know how easily things slip through the cracks.
Exactly. So the doctor pulls out their phone, opens a professional group chat with their colleagues, and sends a quick text asking if anyone happens to know a clinician who is currently working in that specific emergency department or admitting ward.
And As it so often happens in tight-knit professional communities,
Oh.
someone in that group chat sees the message.
Right.
A colleague is currently on shift in that exact ward.
Mm.
So they reply, they step in, they check on the relative, smooth out the administrative bunks, ensure the right tests are ordered promptly.
You just navigate the situation.
Exactly. And the relative gets sorted out efficiently.
Now, I have to play devil's advocate here for a second. When I read that story, my first thought was, wait, isn't that just basic networking?
Yeah.
Like, humans are tribal creatures. We help our families. If I was a plumber and my mom had a leak, I'd call my plumber buddies to get the best parts. Are we really going to pathologize a doctor for sending a text message to help a sick relative? Because that feels, I don't know, overly cynical.
No, no, it's a completely fair point. And the paper actually anticipates that exact reaction.
Oh, it does.
Yeah. Dr. Savely is very explicit about establishing a non-blaming principle.
Yep.
The text is not assigning moral guilt to the doctor for sending the text.
Okay.
Nor is it blaming the colleague for stepping in. The ethical boundary is clear here. The humane act of helping a sick relative navigate a terrifying situation is not a wrongdoing. It is a natural protective instinct.
Okay, good. Because let's be real, if my mom is sick, I am absolutely using every single contact in my phone to get her help.
Of course you are. Anyone would. But the analysis requires us to look at the dual nature of this event.
On the surface, yes, it is a beautiful display of professional solidarity and human compassion. But if we pull the camera back and look at the whole ward, that text message exposes a terrifying counterfactual.
The counterfactual being the person in the bed right next to the relative.
Exactly. What happens to the similarly sick patient in the next bed over? The patient whose family doesn't have a doctor in their contacts.
Yeah.
They have no insider connection. They have no one who speaks the highly specialized medical language. They don't know the difference between an attending physician, a resident, or a charge nurse.
Right. So they don't know who to appeal to when things stall.
Precisely. That single text message reveals that we aren't just looking at one healthcare system in that building. We're actually looking at three distinct, overlapping systems occupying the exact same institutional space.
Three systems operating simultaneously. Okay, let's break those down because this framework totally blew my mind.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So the first is what the paper calls the formal system. This is the one we are all taught to believe in.
The official version.
Right. It's the brochure version of the hospital. It's the laws, the official organizational charts, the stated triage protocols, the referral pathways printed on the hospital website.
And the entitlements you supposedly have as a citizen or a policyholder, like the system as it exists on paper, step A leads to step B, which leads to a cure.
Exactly. But anyone who has been sick knows that paper doesn't heal you, which leads to the second system.
Okay.
The operational system. This is the messy, chaotic reality of what patients and healthcare workers actually encounter on a random Tuesday afternoon.
Right, the reality.
It's the waiting room with standing room only. It's the physical paper file that got lost between the third and fourth floors. It's the scarcity of open beds, the delayed lab results.
The exhausted nurse who has 12 patients instead of six.
Yes.
It's the friction of reality, the gap between the brochure and the building. And because that operational system is so fraught, it births the third system.
Which is the shadow access system. This is the hidden architecture we mentioned earlier.
Shadow system.
Yeah. It consists of the personal phone calls, the insider knowledge, mm-hmm. the professional advocacy, even private under-the-table payments in some regions.
Wow.
And all the improvised workarounds that people use to bypass the chaos of the operational system.
So the shadow system is essentially a VIP fast pass lane, but instead of buying it at a ticket booth, it's hidden behind the scenes.
Exactly.
Now, here's where my brain got stuck when I was reading this. If the formal system, like the official triage protocols, the standard way you get admitted, if that actually works, the shadow system shouldn't need to exist, right?
That is the core deduction, yes. Yeah. The shadow system is defined in the paper as an adaptive infrastructure.
Adaptive infrastructure.
Right. Its very existence is the ultimate proof that the formal system is unreliable. I mean, people don't use the shadow system because they want to be malicious or elitist.
They use it because they have to.
Exactly. They use it because they fundamentally cannot trust the formal pathways to recognize the urgency of their suffering, coordinate their movement, or communicate clearly.
So, using a contact to bypass the waiting room isn't just a perk of being well-connected. It's literally a survival mechanism because the waiting room itself is broken.
And that survival mechanism introduces a massive philosophical problem. Which brings us to one of the most powerful concepts in Dr. Saley's analysis. Just a very simple phrase.
What is it?
Availability is not access.
Availability is not access. I love this distinction. When I was reading this part, I immediately thought of an analogy.
Let's hear it.
Let's say I hand you a free golden ticket to the most exclusive, amazing concert in the world. Formally, according to the system, you have availability. The ticket has your name on it. It is yours.
Okay, I have the ticket.
But there's a catch. The concert is taking place on a private island 300 miles away. You don't own a boat. There are no commercial ferries that go there. And to make matters worse, the ticket doesn't even say what time the show starts.
Oh, wow.
Right. So technically, the concert is fully available to you. But practically, your access is absolute zero. The entitlement on paper is entirely useless without the logistical means to convert it.
That analogy perfectly captures the systemic illusion. Because health ministries and hospital boards, they love to measure their success by counting physical things.
Like beds.
Right. They measure the number of facilities built, the number of beds physically present in a room, or the number of highly trained specialists on the payroll. Those metrics represent availability.
Sure.
But having a building with a bed in it does not mean a human being can actually convert their formal right to care into timely, effective treatment. Healthcare access isn't a static state.
It's an action.
It is a conversion chain.
And a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. Like, if any part breaks, you don't get care.
Exactly. The paper outlines six specific sequential gates of practical access, and a patient has to successfully survive and pass through every single one of these gates to actually receive care.
Every single one.
Yes. If a system fails a patient at gate two, it doesn't matter how beautiful the surgical suite is at gate six.
Let's organically trace a patient trying to get through these gates. Let's imagine a patient, we'll call him Marcus.
Okay, Marcus.
So Marcus wakes up in his apartment and his chest is tight. He needs a doctor. Before he even thinks about an x-ray or a stethoscope, what is the very first barrier he faces? Let me guess, getting there. The physical reality of distance.
Precisely. That is gate one, geographical and logistical.
Okay.
Does Marcus have a car? If not, is there a reliable bus route? Does the ambulance service actually have gas and available drivers?
Right.
And it's not just transport. Can Marcus get time off from his hourly job without being fired? Can he find someone to watch his kids? If the clinic is open, but Marcus is trapped at work or blocked by a flooded road, the hospital's availability is zero.
Okay, so let's say Marcus borrows his neighbor's car and makes it to the clinic parking lot. He's through gate one, but he hasn't even walked in the door yet. The next barrier has to be the wallet.
It is. Gate two, financial. And a critical nuance here is that this applies even in countries with nominally free universal healthcare.
Really? How so?
Because we aren't just talking about a hospital bill. We are talking about the hidden indirect costs. Did Marcus have to pay his neighbor for gas? Did he lose a day's wages to be there?
Oh, right.
If the public pharmacy is out of stock, does he have the cash to go down the street and buy the antibiotics at a private pharmacy?
Those out-of-pocket, hidden costs that quietly drain a family's savings. Okay, so Marcus scrapes together the cash for parking and walks into the massive hospital lobby. Now he's staring at 10 different hallways and a directory board that looks like it's written in hieroglyphics.
Which brings us to gate three, informational.
Does
Marcus know which department handles his specific type of chest pain? Does he have the health literacy to articulate his symptoms in a way the triage nurse will flag as urgent?
And does he know the bureaucratic requirements, the necessary identification, the referral forms?
Exactly. And if he gets confused, who does he ask? Which brings us back to the doctor with a text message.
Gate four,
relational. This is the currency of the shadow system. If Marcus gets stuck in the lobby, does he have an advocate?
Right.
Does he have a social connection, a family friend, or a professional who can vouch for him, translate the jargon, and pull a few strings to get him past the administrative blockade?
Mm. But let's say Marcus doesn't have a doctor in his phone. He's just a regular guy. He waits in line, finally gets up to the triage desk, and tells the nurse his chest hurts. But Marcus is, maybe he's homeless, or maybe he doesn't speak the dominant language well, or maybe he has a known history of substance abuse.
And suddenly the gate slams shut.
Yeah.
Gate five is institutional recognition.
Yeah.
And honestly, it is arguably the most insidious.
Because it's about judgment.
Exactly. Is Marcus's suffering recognized as legitimate? Or is his urgency being actively discounted due to social stigma, racial bias, ageism, or classism? If the institution looks at Marcus and decides, consciously or unconsciously, that his pain isn't a priority because of who he is, all the medical technology in the building is useless to him.
That is heavy. Because you can have the money, the transport, and the paperwork, but if the human being at the desk decides your pain isn't real, you're done.
You're completely done.
Okay, but let's be optimistic. The triage nurse takes him seriously. He's rushed to the back.
Gate 6, coordinated clinical capacity. Can the institution actually convert their recognition of his problem into a physical action? Is there an empty bed?
Is the EKG machine working or is it broken?
Right. Is the specialist on duty or did they migrate to another country last month?
So 6 gates: logistics, finances, information, relationships, recognition, and finally, capacity. Missing any single one completely nullifies the hospital's existence for that patient.
It does. And understanding these gates illuminates another major concept the paper introduces, which is differential friction.
Differential friction. I love the physical imagery of that. Tell me how friction works here.
So institutional barriers, the broken machines, the long wait times, the lost paperwork, these are the frictions of the operational system.
Okay.
But the crucial insight is that the exact same point of friction imposes completely unequal differential consequences depending on a patient's private resources.
Give me a concrete example. Let's put 2 patients side by side.
Okay. Let's take a broken diagnostic scanner at a public hospital. That is the institutional friction.
Got it.
Patient A is a wealthy executive. Patient B is a minimum wage worker. They both need an urgent scan to check for a growing tumor. The hospital says the machine is down. The wait list is now 3 weeks long.
Okay, they both hit the same wall.
But the bounce back is entirely different. For patient A, the executive with deep pockets, that friction is merely a frustrating inconvenience.
Because he can just buy his way out.
Exactly. He uses his resources, books an appointment at a private boutique clinic across town, pays out of pocket, gets the scan the next morning, and returns to his oncologist to start treatment.
And patient B?
Patient B has no extra money. They cannot bypass the friction. For them, that exact same broken scanner isn't an inconvenience. It is a profound, life-altering delay.
Oh, man.
They wait the 3 weeks. During that time, the tumor grows. By the time they get the scan, the cancer has metastasized. The exact same systemic failure harmed the poorer patient exponentially more.
Because patient A used private capital to buy their way around the friction.
Yes.
And when you synthesize all of this, the shadow system, the 6 gates, the differential friction, what does this map actually show us? What is the macro diagnosis?
The diagnosis is healthcare enclosure.
Healthcare enclosure.
Yes. When we usually hear the word enclosure or privatization, we think of the legal transfer of a public asset to a corporation.
Right. We think of a government literally selling a hospital to a private equity firm, changing the name on the building and jacking up the prices.
Exactly. But Dr. Senhealy argues that enclosure is happening covertly, even in systems that remain fiercely public on paper.
Covertly enclosed.
A publicly funded, nominally free system becomes enclosed when the means of practically accessing it, the transport, the health literacy, the insider advocacy, the private diagnostic workarounds are all privately held and unequally distributed.
So the taxpayers are funding the existence of the building, but the practical ability to unlock the doors is mediated entirely by your private wealth and social capital.
Right.
The public finances the institution, but families privately finance the waiting, the navigating, and the suffering.
Precisely. And this covert enclosure is why the system feels like it is constantly on the verge of collapsing. Because if access is this difficult, if people are constantly getting trapped behind these gates, they must be getting significantly sicker while they wait.
Which transitions us perfectly into the macro level crisis. I want to push back on a narrative we hear in the media almost every day.
Okay.
Every winter, the news runs stories about overcrowded hospitals, ambulances lined up around the block, and patients sleeping in hallways. And the pundit on TV always says, "It's simple. We have a growing population. We just need to allocate more funding to build more hospital beds and hire more ER doctors."
Right. The simple math solution.
Yeah. They treat it like a simple arithmetic problem of supply and demand. Is it really just about needing more money for the emergency room?
The paper strongly, fundamentally rejects that view. Treating hospital congestion as a simple math problem of we need more beds is a deadly trap.
Why is that a trap?
Because pouring money solely into downstream rescue without understanding how patients arrive at that state is like trying to empty a flooding bathtub with a teaspoon while ignoring the fact that the faucet is running wide open.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Dr. Solney maps out what he calls the multiple curves of healthcare unsustainability. It is not one single crisis. It is 7 distinct coupled curves that actively feed into, accelerate, and intensify each other.
7 curves. Let's trace how they connect. Let's go back to our hypothetical patient, Marcus, and watch how his journey through these curves breaks the system.
Good idea. We start at the true origin. Curve 1 is preventable disease.
Preventable disease. So this is way before the hospital.
Exactly. This is the upstream failure. This is where Marcus is living in an environment with poor air quality, highly processed foods, high chronic stress, and no accessible preventative care. This environment increases his baseline biological need for care.
Right, because if the society you live in is actively making you sick, you are eventually going to need a doctor.
But Marcus hits a friction point. Maybe he can't afford to take time off to see a primary care doctor, which drops us into curve 2.
The fizz.
Acute deterioration. Because his access to early preventative care is delayed or weak, his chronic illness goes unmanaged.
Right, so a small problem becomes a big one.
Yes. A treatable local infection slowly morphs into systemic sepsis. Managed hypertension quietly escalates until it becomes a massive stroke.
So Marcus isn't just arriving at the hospital. He's arriving at the hospital in a catastrophic state.
Exactly. And when hundreds of Marcuses arrive at the same time, we hit curve 3. Congestion.
The overflowing bathtubs.
Right. The emergency room crowds.
Yeah.
The inpatient wards fill up. Transfers from rural clinics are delayed because the central hub is saturated. The physical footprint of the hospital is overwhelmed.
And here is where the economics come in. Because taking care of Marcus's stroke in an intensive care unit with ventilators and neurosurgeons is astronomically more expensive than providing him with generic blood pressure medication 5 years ago.
Which triggers curve 4, financial escalation.
The money runs out.
The cost of downstream rescue spirals completely out of control. It eats up the entire national health budget. Which means the government has absolutely nothing left to spend on the upstream prevention that could have saved Marcus in the first place.
A vicious self-fulfilling economic cycle. Wow. And as the hospital gets more congested and resources become scarce, the gates of access we talked about get much heavier.
Leading to curve 5, access inequality. When formal capacity becomes a scarce commodity, the value of privilege skyrockets.
Right, because there's not enough to go around.
Exactly. If there are only 2 ICU beds left in the entire city, the shadow system of insider influence, professional networking, and private payment becomes the absolute deciding factor in who lives and who dies.
And think about the human beings trying to manage this chaos. The nurses, the doctors, the porters, they are standing in the middle of this hurricane.
This is curve 6, workforce depletion.
The staff.
The staff are crushed by the sheer volume of congestion and the devastating severity of the illnesses they are seeing. They are forced to make impossible, heartbreaking choices every shift.
So they burn out.
They burn out. They suffer moral trauma. They reduce their hours. They migrate to other countries, or they quit the profession entirely.
And the cruel math here is that every single person who leaves makes the burden exponentially heavier for the ones who stay.
Exactly. Which finally brings us to the perspective of the public, watching all of this happen.
Which is curve 7.
Curve 7. Public distrust. Citizens see the exhausted staff, they experience the brutal wait times, they hear the stories of missing medicines, they realize the system is unreliable.
So what do?
They delay seeking care. They try to tough it out at home until the pain is absolutely unbearable.
Oh, which means when they finally do show up, they are even sicker.
Feeding right back into curve 2, and the entire death spiral accelerates.
It's an interlocking machine of unsustainability. And the paper actually quantifies this dynamic with a core formula, doesn't it? The healthcare viability gap.
Yes. It's an elegant way to conceptualize the tipping point. A health system is only viable if its capacities can meet the legitimate need, and this is the critical part, can be continuously restored.
Okay, so what's the formula?
The formula is essentially this.
Yeah.
System pressure, which is the legitimate medical need of the population, plus all the avoidable friction we just discussed, is greater than the sustainably renewable capacity.
Sustainably renewable capacity. That's a fascinating phrase. It's not just about what resources you have in the building today. It's about whether you can generate those same resources again tomorrow.
Right.
But here's where my mind gets really stuck. If the math fundamentally doesn't work, like, if the system pressure is constantly vastly greater than the renewable capacity, how are these hospitals keeping their doors open? Why hasn't the entire global medical infrastructure just halted?
Because of a phenomenon the paper terms borrowed capacity.
Borrowed capacity.
And I would argue this is one of the most vital, piercing insights in the entire analysis. The formal system survives almost entirely on the unpaid,
unrecorded and unseen sacrifices of the human beings inside it.
Paint a picture of what that actually looks like on the ground.
It looks like the bedside nurse working a mandated double shift and skipping her meal so a ward doesn't have to close.
Right.
It looks like the specialist doctor making personal phone calls from his kitchen table on his day off to coordinate a complex patient transfer because the administrative software failed.
It looks like the family members who essentially move into the hospital room bringing clean sheets and bathing their relative because the nursing staff is spread too thin to provide basic hygiene.
Yes, exactly. Or it looks like the mid-level manager who takes on the workload of three vacant positions without extra pay just to keep the procurement office running.
It's the shadow system operating on sheer human sacrifice.
Exactly. And the danger of borrowed capacity is that it creates a terrifying illusion of functionality.
Because it looks like it's working.
Right. The hospital administrators or the government ministers look at their quarterly metrics and say, look, the patients were seen, the surgeries were completed, the ward stayed open, the system is working.
But the system isn't working.
It is not. It is only functioning because compassionate workers and desperate families are personally absorbing the system's massive deficits into their own bodies and minds.
And it's a law of physics. You can't borrow forever without eventually paying it back. You can only skip so many meals before you collapse.
You cannot. Which inevitably leads to what Dr. Soli calls institutional self-consumption.
Institutional self-consumption.
This is the darkest reality of the modern hospital.
Yeah.
The health system is literally eating tomorrow's workforce to survive today.
Oh, wow.
It maintains its current precarious function by progressively depleting the physical health, the public trust, and the moral reserves of the very people it desperately requires to deliver care in the future.
Today's compassion is weaponized to conceal tomorrow's collapse.
Exactly.
Eating tomorrow's workforce to survive today, that is a chilling visual, and it brings us directly to the human toll.
Yes.
We've talked a lot about structural curves, flowcharts, and capacities, but I want to dive deep into what this actually does to the minds and souls of the healthcare workers providing that borrowed capacity.
It's vital to discuss.
Because the paper makes a very deliberate, vital distinction here in the terminology we use to label that psychological damage. Like, we hear the word burnout thrown around constantly in the media.
Right. It's become a catch-all phrase. The doctors are burnt out. The nurses are burnt out.
And the way it's used, we treat it like it's an individual failing, like they just need to practice more mindfulness, take a vacation, or go do a hospital-sponsored yoga class, and they'll be fine.
And that framing is a profoundly dangerous misdiagnosis of what is actually happening.
Why is that dangerous?
Because burnout is a real, documented psychological phenomenon. It's the profound exhaustion, the emotional detachment, and the cynicism that comes from chronic occupational stress.
Right.
But burnout alone does not capture the ethical dimension of the crisis in these hospitals. Dr. Savely draws a sharp line between burnout, moral distress, and moral injury.
Let's separate those out. We know what burnout is. What exactly is moral distress?
Moral distress is highly specific. It occurs when a professional knows exactly what the ethically appropriate care requires. They possess the clinical knowledge, they know the right thing to do, but they cannot provide it because of insurmountable institutional constraints.
Can you give an example?
Let's say a doctor knows a patient desperately needs a specific type of scan to rule out a brain bleed, but the only machine in the hospital has been broken for weeks.
So it's a friction between their professional expertise and the system's failure. They want to heal, but their hands are tied.
Right. It's distressing. But now, take that distress and multiply it. Make it chronic. Make it severe. Have it happen every single day for years. That is where it curdles into moral injury.
Moral injury. That sounds like a wound you'd get in a war zone.
The term actually originated in military psychology. Moral injury is a deep, spiritual, and psychological laceration.
Wow.
It happens when a clinician is forced to repeatedly witness or feel complicit in treatable suffering because the system they work within is fundamentally broken.
Oh, that's brutal.
It's the quiet trauma of having to look a terrified patient in the eye and apologize for delayed surgery that the doctor had absolutely no control over. It's a nurse having to intentionally ration inadequate substandard attention because management assigned her 12 acute patients instead of 4.
It's the heartbreak of a social worker discharging a vulnerable asthmatic person back into a mold-infested apartment, the exact environmental conditions that made them sick in the first place, knowing with absolute certainty they will end up back in the ER in a week.
Yes, that exact feeling.
That is heartbreaking. It completely flips the narrative. It's not that these workers are too tired to care anymore. It's that they care so deeply, and the institutional structure forces them to violate their own moral compass every single time they clock in.
And the paper diagnoses how this happens through a mechanism called ethical load transfer.
Ethical load transfer. Explain the mechanics of that.
Think about the laws of gravity. Systemic failures don't just evaporate into the ether.
Right. They have to go somewhere.
If there is a massive lack of resources, a failure in national governance, a bungled procurement contract, or a slashed budget, the consequences of that failure flow downward.
Okay.
The administration or the government fails to secure enough physical beds, but the executives who made that decision aren't the ones standing at the bedside when the patient arrives.
They're far away from it.
The frontline worker, the bedside nurse, the junior doctor, the orderly, is left holding what the paper profoundly calls the impossible residue.
Because they are the physical face of the system to the suffering patient.
Yes. The system effectively transfers the moral consequences of its macro-level scarcity directly onto the shoulders of those closest to the patient, who are paradoxically the least empowered to repair the structural causes.
Well, that is so unfair.
The patient is in pain, they are scared, and they direct their entirely justifiable anger at the nurse, assuming the nurse is lazy or doesn't care.
Right.
The nurse, absorbing this anger, internalizes the structural inability as a personal professional failure. And the vertical source of the problem, the administrative policy or financial failure that actually caused the shortage, remains completely obscured from view while the people at the bottom fight each other in the hallway.
It's a brilliant, tragic misdirection of accountability. The people who break the system are shielded by the bodies of the people trying to hold it together. And this dynamic creates what the paper highlights as a painful irony, which is the compassion paradox.
The compassion paradox is the ultimate trap of a caring profession.
How does it trap them?
It dictates that the more committed, generous, and self-sacrificing the workforce and the families are, the longer a completely incoherent, broken system can avoid confronting its own failures.
Wow.
Because the workers are so dedicated to preventing patient death, they perform miracles, they work the double shifts, they use the shadow system. And their extraordinary superhuman effort becomes normalized by the administration as the baseline standard of operations.
So their profound compassion becomes a hidden subsidy that allows bad governance and chronic underfunding to continue unchecked. I want to pause here. I want you, the listener, to really think about this dynamic for a second, because it applies far beyond the walls of a hospital. Think about how often in your own job or your own community or even your family life, your personal sense of responsibility is quietly exploited to cover up a structural failure.
It's a very common human experience.
Like, have you ever worked at a company where upper management rolled out a terrible, buggy new software system, and the only reason the business didn't instantly grind to a halt was because you and your coworkers stayed late every single night, off the clock, manually fixing the errors?
Right, the silent fixers.
Your dedication, your refusal to let the project fail, actually prevented the higher-ups from realizing how catastrophic their decision was. Now multiply that scenario by life and death stakes, bleeding patients, and grieving families.
Yeah.
That is ethical load transfer. That is the compassion paradox.
And if we take that massive accumulation of moral injury, borrowed capacity, and systemic friction, and we ask, where does all of this finally boil over into public view? The answer is always the same.
Where is it?
It boils over in the emergency room.
Which takes us to the ER as the ultimate systemic pressure gauge. Mm-hmm.
The emergency department is the most visible tip of a massive submerged systemic iceberg. It receives the undifferentiated illness of the entire society.
It's the ultimate catch-all.
It absorbs the social distress, the failures of delayed primary care, the consequences of poverty, and all the people who simply have no other dependable point of access. When the system fails upstream, the floodwaters always rush into the ER.
And when we hear about ER crises, the word that always comes up is boarding. What exactly is boarding in this context?
Boarding is a critical bottleneck. It happens when a patient has been triaged, evaluated by the ER doctors, and it has been determined that they are sick enough to need admission to the main hospital.
Okay, so they need a bed upstairs.
Right, but there are no beds available upstairs in the specialized inpatient wards. So the patient is held or boarded in the emergency department.
They just stay there.
They might be parked on a gurney in a loud, brightly lit hallway for hours or sometimes even days, waiting for a spot upstairs to open.
And the domino effect there is obvious. If that patient is taking up a bed in the ER hallway, that bed cannot be used to intake the person having a heart attack in the ambulance pulling up outside.
Precisely. The ER effectively paralyzes. But what Dr. Sahili stresses, drawing heavily on international data like the AHRQ summits, is that boarding is emphatically not an ER inefficiency problem.
It's not the ER's fault.
Exactly. You cannot fix boarding by bringing in consultants to tweak the ER's internal triage workflow. Boarding is a whole system failure.
What's failing specifically?
It is a failure of community access, a failure of specialist doctors reviewing cases fast enough, a failure of ward staffing upstairs, and a failure of social care to safely discharge recovered patients back to their homes. A blockage literally anywhere in the entire health ecosystem propagates backward and eventually pools in the emergency department.
It really emphasizes how incredibly mundane, unglamorous administrative frictions have massive, catastrophic biological consequences.
They really do.
The paper mentions scenarios that sound like simple HR mix-ups or minor logistics issues, but they act as systemic tripwires. For example, a ward bed might actually be clean and empty upstairs, but there is no porter on shift to physically push the patient's wheelchair from the ER to the elevator.
Or an ambulance is sitting idle in the loading bay for 3 hours awaiting complex authorization paperwork from an insurance company.
Right.
Or a critical diagnostic lab result isn't communicated because two hospital computer systems were bought from different vendors and literally cannot talk to each other.
Oh, that's maddening.
Or an elderly patient is perfectly healthy and ready to be discharged, but they cannot leave the hospital bed because the social care agency hasn't delivered their home oxygen tank yet.
And while that healthy patient occupies the bed waiting for an oxygen tank, someone with a ruptured appendix is waiting in the ER lobby because there's nowhere to put them. It's a terrifying domino effect of administrative pebbles causing clinical avalanches.
Which is why the paper brings up a fascinating paradigm-shifting point regarding hospital governance. It cites a specific 2026 report from the University Hospital of the West Indies Institutional Review Committee.
Okay, what did the report say?
The report documented deep, chronic weaknesses in management, procurement, and maintenance. And the takeaway here isn't to point fingers at one specific hospital in the Caribbean. It's to illustrate a universal global truth.
Which is?
Governance is a clinical determinant of health.
Governance isn't just shuffling paperwork in a boardroom.
No. Procurement policies, equipment maintenance contracts, and clear lines of administrative authority determine whether a patient lives or dies just as much as a surgeon's scalpel. If a multi-million dollar MRI machine is sitting broken for months because a hospital administration let the service contract lapse to save budget, that is a clinical failure, not just an administrative oversight.
Because it stops care.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Distal governance decisions dictate the physical reality at the bedside. You can hire the most brilliant doctors in the world, but if the procurement team hasn't bought the correct size of IV tubing, the care completely stops.
Which circles us right back to a trap we touched on earlier, the reactive care trap.
Yes.
If the ER is overflowing because the MRI is broken or because primary care failed, the instinctive, reflexive political response is always, we need to build a massive new ER wing, or we need to double the size of the intensive care unit. The paper explains exactly why this instinct is not just wrong, but actively harmful.
It comes down to the asymmetry of visibility.
Asymmetry of visibility. Explain that.
Acute illness, a massive heart attack, a car crash trauma, a severe stroke demands immediate visceral moral action. You cannot look at a patient bleeding in front of you and tell them to wait for long-term social housing reform.
Right. You have to act now.
So the hospitals, the shiny emergency services, and the rescue helicopters command all the political visibility and consequently all the financing. Their outputs are highly countable and highly dramatic.
Like new beds opened, ambulances purchased, heroic lives saved in the OR.
Exactly.
It makes for a phenomenal ribbon-cutting ceremony for a politician running for re-election. Look at this giant new building I funded.
Exactly. But prevention has a massive fatal visibility problem. The success of prevention is an event that does not happen.
Right. You cannot photograph the heart attack that didn't happen because a patient had access to a quiet, boring clinic and good blood pressure medication for the last 10 years.
There is no dramatic rescue.
There's no soaring music. It's just normal life continuing.
Because of this invisibility, the health budget constantly, inevitably shifts downstream to rescue medicine. It starves primary care, social work, and public health prevention.
Which just makes the problem worse.
Exactly. And because prevention is starved, more people get sick, which creates even more desperate demand for the ER, which shifts even more money downstream to build bigger ERs. That is the reactive care trap. It's an infinite loop of chasing the symptoms.
And it feels like whenever society does try to talk about prevention, it immediately devolves into a really unhelpful, toxic guilt trip. The false choice of responsibility.
The blame game, yes.
It becomes all about blaming the individual patient. You need to eat better. You need to exercise more. Stop smoking. It's your fault you're in the ER.
The paper addresses this head on, and it is a crucial philosophical intervention. It argues that a simplistic, individualized prevention narrative can quickly become just another form of systemic abandonment.
Right.
Yes, individual agency matters.
Mm.
But responsibility is only meaningful and can only be ethically assigned if a person possesses some genuine practical capacity to act differently.
You cannot legitimately tell a mother to feed her children a nutritious diet of fresh vegetables if she lives in a recognized food desert where the only affordable, accessible option within a 2-mile radius is highly processed fast food at a gas station.
You cannot.
You cannot tell a man to go for a jog every evening for his heart health if he is working 3 grueling jobs just to make rent and his neighborhood lacks sidewalks and isn't safe to walk in after dark.
Precisely. Blaming the individual in those circumstances is intellectually dishonest. And this is where Dr. Saley introduces a brilliant, impartial framework, the distributed responsibility matrix.
Okay.
It proposes a sliding scale of accountability
mm-hmm.
guided by a simple principle.
Which is?
Responsibility should rise proportionately with power, knowledge, and capacity.
Okay, let's unpack this matrix because it assigns very different levels of responsibility to different actors in society. Let's start at the bottom.
We start with individuals. Individuals do have a baseline level of responsibility. They are responsible for reasonable self-care, for truthful communication with their doctors, and for seeking help when they can.
But again, this responsibility is strictly bounded by their realistic options and resources.
Correct. And as we move up the ladder of power,
next are institutions, hospitals, clinics, and professional bodies.
They hold far more power than the individual. Therefore, they are responsible for ensuring safe staffing ratios, creating transparent access pathways, ensuring their equipment actually works, and crucially, protecting their workforce from the moral injury we discussed.
Moving higher, we hit governments.
Governments have immense society-shaping power. Therefore, their responsibility is vast. They're responsible for hard infrastructure, macroeconomic social policy, equitable financing, regulating environmental hazards, and creating health-supporting conditions in housing and transport.
And finally, a very interesting group that usually escapes the healthcare conversation entirely, commercial actors.
Yes. Corporations and commercial entities hold massive societal power. Therefore, they hold responsibility for product design, aggressive marketing practices, and the environmental impact of their operations.
Makes sense.
The paper's logic is clear. If a massive commercial system spends billions of dollars engineering and aggressively marketing a highly addictive, ultra-processed product, they cannot then turn around and attribute the resulting national diabetes epidemic entirely to the deficient personal discipline of the consumer.
Right.
They hold responsibility proportionate to their immense power to amplify harm.
Now, I want to pause here and be very clear for our listeners. We are analyzing the matrix of power dynamics exactly as it is laid out in this academic white paper.
Absolutely.
We are not using this deep dive to endorse any specific political ideology, left or right, regarding state regulation or government intervention in the free market. The text is simply observing from a cold systemic viewpoint that if you want to fix the machine of public health, you have to acknowledge who actually holds the levers of power over the environment that creates illness.
It's an impartial analysis of cause and effect.
Right. It's just tracing the lines.
It is an analytical framework, not a partisan one. The guiding rule of the matrix is simply this. Responsibility for addressing the root causes of disease rises with power, while access to treatment follows human need.
Meaning?
A causal understanding of how a patient got sick should guide our preventative policies. It should never determine a person's human worth or their right to receive compassionate care once they are lying in a hospital bed.
Such a crucial distinction. Now, to really see how all of these massive vulnerabilities play out in real time, the paper grounds its analysis in a very specific, unforgiving geographical context.
The Caribbean.
Yes, Caribbean Crucible.
This is where Dr. Soheli's Caribbean-grounded global analysis comes into focus. Why the Caribbean? Why are small islands the perfect lens for this?
Because small island developing states operate with absolutely zero margin for error. They are the ultimate extreme stress test for health system viability.
Also, think of a massive healthcare system in a huge country, like a vast forest. If you cut down a few trees, the forest easily absorbs the shock. But an island is like a closed terrarium. If you remove one element, the entire ecosystem collapses.
Oh, wow.
The vulnerabilities we've been discussing, workforce depletion, equipment failure, logistical friction, are magnified exponentially in an island context.
The paper introduces a concept called the small numbers paradox. Explain that dynamic.
Let's use the forest analogy again. In a large country like the United States or the UK, if a hospital loses one highly trained specialist, say, an anesthesiologist or an intensive care doctor, it's a frustrating localized problem.
Sure.
The hospital might have to hire an expensive temporary doctor or divert some ambulances to a neighboring city a few miles away, but the national system absorbs the shock.
Right, there's a buffer.
In a small island state, losing one single specialist can quite literally wipe out an entire national service.
Wow. One retirement or one doctor suffering from moral injury who decides to migrate to a wealthier country with better pay, and suddenly an entire sovereign nation has no pediatric intensive care coverage.
Exactly. Absolute losses that seem statistically, numerically tiny, one doctor, one specialized biomedical engineer produce disproportionately massive functional collapses on the ground.
And then there is the logistical nightmare of the geography itself. We talked about transport earlier as just getting in a car, but the paper frames island transport not just as a ride to the hospital, but as an actual clinical pathway.
It is a critical paradigm shift. Getting in an ambulance in a city is just a taxi ride with sirens. But in an archipelago, the transport is the care.
The transport is the care.
In an island setting, a referral to a specialist isn't just about calling a receptionist to make an appointment. It's about monitoring ocean weather conditions. It's about checking inter-island ferry schedules.
Right.
It's about whether the medical aircraft has fuel and clearance to fly. A doctor's medical decision to transfer a patient is completely meaningless until the logistical transfer is actually completed. The physical geography and the weather dictate whether care happens or not.
And that extreme vulnerability ties into the technological side, too. The paper discusses acquisition capacity versus functional capacity.
This is a massive issue for import-dependent nations, and it exposes the flaws in how global health funding usually works.
How does it usually work?
A government might secure an international grant to buy a state-of-the-art, high-tech piece of diagnostic equipment. An MRI machine, for instance, that is acquisition capacity. They bought the box. They have it.
The box is on the island. Ribbon-cutting time again.
But functional capacity is entirely different. Buying the physical machine is totally useless if the island doesn't also have the supply chain to import the proprietary replacement parts when it breaks.
Oh.
It's useless if they don't have the highly trained technicians on the island to service it. It's useless if the national power grid is subject to rolling blackouts, or if a Category 5 hurricane knocks out the electricity for 3 months.
Procurement is only life coherent if it includes the entire service ecology required to keep the technology alive.
Because if a hurricane hits, that multi-million dollar machine is just an incredibly expensive paperweight in a dark room.
Which necessitates what the paper insists on as a core solution. Regional cooperation.
Right, because the mathematical reality is that no single small island state can efficiently, sustainably reproduce every single specialist service, every high-level reference laboratory, and every biomedical engineering team.
They have to pool their life capacity.
They need shared specialist networks that cross national borders, reciprocal emergency transfer agreements, and joint regional training programs. For small states, regional cooperation isn't just polite diplomacy. It is an absolute biological survival necessity.
Okay. We have thoroughly diagnosed the disease. We've mapped the shadow system, the six gates of friction, the interlocking curve, the moral injury, the reactive care trap, and the precariousness of the terrarium. Now we move to the cure. How do we build what Dr. Sagley calls a life-coherent health system?
The paper outlines a comprehensive architecture built on seven interdependent domains. And the overarching goal here requires a massive paradigm shift.
What's the shift?
The central metric of success for the system must be viable life capacity, not just administrative throughput.
We aren't just trying to see how fast you can push people through a revolving door. We are trying to build a system that sustains life.
Exactly.
The paper lays out seven domains and an eight-stage regenerative loop. Rather than just listing them out like an academic index, let's apply them. Let's bring Marcus back. How does a life coherent system treat Marcus differently from the beginning?
In a life coherent system, we start with the first stage of the loop, protect from harm. The system integrates with social policy to ensure Marcus isn't living in an environment that guarantees illness.
Okay. But if he does get sick?
The second stage is detect illness early. This means robust, trusted primary care in his neighborhood, so his blood pressure is caught before it's a crisis.
And if it escalates?
Stage three, respond with timely care. If Marcus needs the hospital, the pathways are clear. Stage four, restore function, providing the acute care. Stage five, support, ensuring that if he can't be fully cured, he has palliative or social support.
But the loop doesn't end when Marcus leaves the hospital.
Exactly. Stage six is learn from failures. The system analyzes why Marcus got sick in the first place.
Smart.
Stage seven is renew. The system actively replenishes the energy and resources of the nurses and doctors who treated him, preventing moral injury. And finally, stage eight, realign.
Realign.
The system uses Marcus's data to change the upstream policies to protect the next person. It's a closed regenerative circle.
But inside all of this systemic theory is one specific proposal that I found completely wonderfully mind-bending.
Oh, the shadow system part.
Yes. It's about how to handle the shadow system, the doctor texting his buddy. The instinctive, punitive reaction from an administrator would be to say, the shadow system is unfair, VIP access is wrong, therefore we must destroy it.
Ban doctors from helping their relative.
Institute strict rules against insider access. But the paper says something entirely different.
It says, do not destroy the shadow system's functions. Universalize them.
Universalize the shadow system. Explain how that works in practice.
Think deeply about what the privileged patient actually receives when they call their insider buddy in the hospital. What are they getting?
They get orientation, someone calmly telling them exactly where to go.
They get fast tracking, someone accurately recognizing the urgency of their pain. They get communication, someone translating the terrifying medical jargon into plain language.
They get logistical coordination.
Exactly. These are not malicious things. In fact, these are the exact components of high quality, humane, compassionate care.
They are beautiful things. They just shouldn't be exclusive to people who happen to have the right phone numbers in their contacts.
Exactly. The solution is not to banish compassion. The solution is to institutionalize those informal functions. What the privileged patient gets through a buddy, the formal hospital system must proactively provide to every single person who walks through the door.
Wow.
You achieve this through universal patient navigation services, dedicated care coordinators whose only job is to guide patients, real-time capacity tracking, and clear, transparent escalation pathways when care stalls. You take the VIP back door, you tear it off its hinges, and you build it into the front entrance for everyone.
That is profound. It's taking the best parts of human nature and scaling them up. But to make sure hospitals are actually doing this, the paper proposes a brand new way to measure success. Because we established that just counting empty beds is a flawed metric. Dr. Saily proposes something called the Shadow Access Dependency Index.
Yes. This is a brilliant disruptive way to force the system to clearly see its own inequities.
How does it work?
Instead of an administrator just asking, what is our bed occupancy rate today? Or how fast did we discharge people? The hospital asks the patients directly about their experience of friction.
So you surveyed a patient and ask, did you feel you needed an insider contact to get timely care today?
Did you have to pay privately out of pocket for a scan just to skip the public waiting list? Did you need a family member to aggressively advocate for you because you felt the staff wasn't listening to your pain?
Did you need professional medical knowledge just to identify the correct person to talk to?
By measuring these specific questions, you are directly measuring the failure of the formal pathway. You are quantifying exactly how dependent your hospital is on privilege, out-of-pocket wealth, and exhausting workarounds.
If your shadow access dependency index is high, it means your formal brochure version of the hospital is a ghost town, and everyone is just desperately surviving in the shadows.
And that metric forces undeniable accountability. The ultimate goal of all these reforms, the regenerative loop, the universal navigation, the distributed responsibility matrix, is summarized in one required monumental transition.
What's the transition?
The health system must move from relying on heroic rescue by connection to providing dependable care by right.
From heroic rescue by connection to dependable care by right. Human solidarity, compassion, and doctors helping their families should absolutely still exist, but they should enrich an already functioning system.
Right. They should not act as a desperate, exhausting substitute for an absent one.
Exactly. Every person, regardless of their income, their geography, their physical disability, or their social connections, should be able to convert their legitimate medical need into timely, dignified care without utterly destroying the souls of the healthcare workers providing it.
It is a blueprint for viability.
What an incredible, clarifying framework. Dr. Saheeli has taken this nebulous, frustrating feeling that we have all experienced sitting in waiting rooms, lost in bureaucratic mazes, and he has articulated the exact mechanical architecture behind it.
He really has.
It is so powerful because it shifts the blame. It shifts the blame off the exhausted doctors, off the morally injured nurses, and off the desperate patients who are just trying to survive the friction. It puts the focus squarely on designing a system that actually renews rather than consumes its people.
It asks us to bravely look past the comforting illusion of functionality, to stop accepting borrowed capacity as normal, and to demand a system that operates fully in the light.
And that brings us to the end of our deep dive today. But before we go, I want to leave you, our listener, with a final thought to mull over. We've spent this time talking about the healthcare viability gap, about massive hospitals surviving on borrowed capacity and institutional self-consumption.
It's a lot to take in.
But take this lens, take this exact framework, and turn it inward. Look at your own life, your community, your family, or your workplace. Yeah.
Where are you currently surviving on borrowed capacity? Mm-hmm. Are you relying on the shadow systems of your own unpaid time, your skipped lunches, and your emotional overextension to cover up a fundamentally broken process in your job or your relationships? Mm-hmm. Are you the hidden subsidy keeping a dysfunctional system afloat?
A very tough question to ask yourself.
And more importantly, if you are the one providing that borrowed capacity, how long until it runs out? Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We hope it gave you a new way to see the invisible systems governing our lives. Until next time.